Hey, everyone. This is the Dream It Alive show. I'm your host, Ash Kumra, co-founder of DreamItAlive.com. Today's show is an awesome show. We're actually talking to the authors of The Self-Made Billionaire Effect. This is a really profound book. I actually read this recently, and I was fortunate enough to have gotten this from their team. And, you know, with DreamItAlive.com, we're all about what it takes to become the best version of yourself. As you know, we're a global community that provides visualization tools, dream boards, and helpful personal development content. And to manifest your dreams, I've always felt that it's one thing just to visualize. It's another thing to put it down on your goal-setting tool, i.e. dream board. But it's another thing to get helpful content to really inspire you and also give you the know-all to manifest those dreams. And this book is really cool because they actually talk to, or I should say profile, very successful billionaires. And what's more impressive is that the billionaires that they had reviewed were self-made billionaires. They weren't people that, you know, were given a silver spoon or inherited some large fortune. They were people like Mark Cuban, as many of you know, the infamous judge on Shark Tank, self-made billionaire, owner of the Dallas Mavericks, to the individual that created Red Bull, which has created a whole not only billionaire wealth for himself, but a multi-billion dollar energy drink industry, and various other people too. And so I'm hoping for this interview that we can learn from the authors what it takes to, of course, become a billionaire self-made, but also more realistically, what does it take to achieve your financial and wealth dreams? What are the traits and things that you need to do on a daily basis? So how are you guys doing today?
Doing well, Ash. This is John Sviokla.
Hey, John. So, John, tell us a little about your background, specifically what made you want to write this book.
Sure, Ash. First, thanks for having me on the show. Unfortunately, I don't think Mitch can join us, but my background, I started out my professional life as a business academic. I taught at Harvard Business School for about a dozen years, and then I was a consultant at a place called Diamond Management, and then we were acquired by Pricewaterhouse, PwC, and I head up our thought leadership and work in our consulting business, and it's just been a fantastic ride.
Okay.
In terms of the genesis of the book, we're always interested at PwC in value creation, right? How do we help our clients create value? How do we sustain, measure value? How do you, you know, extract the most value out of the opportunity? And it occurred to us, why don't we look at the people who are just the best at it? And we started to look in the literature and everything, and there was no study of people who had made, you know, amazing fortunes. And we wondered if there's anything we could learn from them to teach our clients and corporate executives and, you know, the average Joe on the street, you know, things about value creation. And that was really the genesis of the story.
Okay. Well, I'm curious, just to get really dive into the book, who was your most favorite billionaire that you interviewed and why?
Well, I will tell you, first of all, it is hard to choose because we interviewed 16 of them and I was in 14 of the interviews, and they're all fascinating in their own way. And interestingly, when they spent time with us, they were never interrupted. The interviews lasted between 2 and 8 hours, and we were always with them, you know, the whole time, and it was just fantastic. But I would have to say Mark Cuban is right up there. You know, he's brilliant. He's quick-witted. You know, he's innovated in a bunch of different industries. You know, he's very personable, nice guy. I was very impressed by Mark. I would say another person who very few people know about is Glenn Taylor, the guy who did Taylor Industries. He controls about 50% of the wedding invitation market, and he just did an amazing job of carving out, you know, a tremendous fortune in a very competitive business. And actually, Ash, that's one of the most fascinating things about the book, about the research. And you know from reading it that 4 out of 5 of these billionaires made their money in hugely, hugely mature and competitive markets. So opportunities all around you. Sometimes you have to think you have to be Christopher Columbus and go across the ocean, but you may have that fortune right on your own shores.
Okay. Well, I want to dive into Mark Cuban specifically because I did mention him, and I'm glad that you mentioned that. What are some of the things you feel that Mark Cuban, and feel free to, you know, promote some of the other people as well, that really stood out, and you're just like, you know what, this is why they're the 1% successful, not 1% like, you know, that financial term that we've referenced for uber wealthy people. I'm talking about 1% successful people. Like, they just, you know why they're ahead of the game.
Sure. Well, I think a critical thing is that they look at opportunity and risk differently. So when you hear from Mark, you know, he'll say you only have to be right once, and, you know, don't mortgage to start your business and so forth. And what that's a part of is a pattern of what we saw, what we might call relative risk-taking, that they know if they can win big. And their biggest concern really is, can they play again, not do they win every time. And you saw that time and time again. Most of these billionaires had a failure or two in their history. And so, you know, you look at a guy like Philip Anschutz, who now owns the Staples Center and has developed downtown L.A. His first fortune was actually in the oil business. And Anschutz had leased a whole bunch of territory in North Texas. And he's driving away from it. And he got word that his oil fields were on fire. And he had no money left to pay Red Adair, the very famous firefighter, to put the fire out. And what he did was he called up Red Adair, and Red said, you know, I really need to get paid. I don't know how you're going to do it. Then he called up the producers of the movie Hellfighters, and he offered them for about $100,000 that they could film his burning oil fields, and they used that money to pay Red Adair. So there's a guy who's got, yeah, I mean, talk about, you know, a different attitude toward risk. He had the presence of mind to say, who can I sell a burning oil field to so that I can get out of this situation?
That's amazing. Why, okay, and I don't want to give you one of these questions and you're like, why are you asking me this? But I really mean it when I ask you this. Why do you think they're not more self-made billionaires? I mean, it seems like these people have the same gifts as we have. It seems like they came from the same background that most of us came from. Some of us struggled, some of us didn't struggle. Mm-hmm. Why are there few self-made billionaires?
Well, I think that most people don't act on their ideas. So in the book, you know, we've got this notion of empathetic imagination and inventive execution. And so, you know, a lot of people have insights into what might be coming, but they don't act on it. And when they do act on it, sometimes, you know, they overanalyze it. It's important to do analysis, but to get out in the marketplace and really try. And the other thing people don't do is that they don't necessarily time it right. So I think those are big differences. And so when you look at something like John Paul DeJoria, who started Paul Mitchell Systems, yep, the way he started Patron Tequila was he had another even more successful company in terms of financial return. The way he started Patron is he had a friend going down to Mexico, and that person brought back some good tequila and also a funky bottle. And he said, look, why don't we launch a premium tequila? They had seen some of the premium vodkas coming in, but they didn't do a ton of market analysis and all that other stuff. What they did is they said, look, I believe there's an opportunity at the top end of the market. They priced it at $39.95, which was twice what the premium tequila in the market was. They put it in the fancy bottle, and then they built 1,000 cases, and John Paul DeJoria gave it to some of his friends, his celebrity friends. He knew Wolfgang Puck well and so forth, and that was the beginning of Patron Tequila. I think many other people probably looked at the market and said, you know, there's probably a room for a, you know, premium tequila, but people didn't act on it.
Wow. So resilience is one thing you're saying. One thing is just about resilience, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Timing. Okay, so Joe Mansueto, the guy who started Morningstar, which is the rating system for mutual funds, as you know. So Mansueto was working at an asset management company, and he was interested in his own portfolio, and he ordered up all these different reports on the budding mutual fund business. And they're sitting on his kitchen table, and he decides, wow, this is a pain. Somebody could make a business out of this. But he had the patience to wait 18 months to convince himself that mutual funds were going to continue to grow and there were going to be more and more of them, so it would actually be a reasonable business. But he had the persistent, what we call patient urgency. He had the persistence to pay attention, to analyze it, and so forth. And then when the time was right, he wrote his first report, and from there the business just kept compounding, and he made himself over $1 billion.
Wow.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's almost palpable, Ash, when you're with these folks. They... It's not enough for them to think about it. Like, if you're the kind of person who, you know, has been at the cocktail party and said, you know, I thought of that idea, and, you know, when you see a new product in the marketplace, you have to ask yourself why that's the case. One of two things had to happen. Either you really didn't believe in the idea, or there's something holding you back from acting on the things you really believe in. And I would say that these self-made billionaires do sort that out. You know, they're not confused about that. They know whether they really believe in it or not. They'll do their homework. And another amazing thing is they all read, and they read books. So you talk to Mark Cuban, and Mark has had a software guy build him a custom interface so he can monitor information sources that he trusts. He reads all the time. He's very big into personalized medicine and sensors right now. He looks at the Dallas Mavericks and says, you know, the future of personalized medicine is being born at the top end of professional sports. Well, that's a very, you know, he's really seeing that trend. He's reading about it. He's learning about it. And he believes you have to be better informed than the competition to win. A lot of people just don't make the time to do that.
Okay. I'm curious, did any of the people that you had interviewed talk about their habits and rituals? Like, I mean, as I mentioned in the beginning of this interview, I mean, we're all about, with DreamAlive.com, setting goals, visualizing, putting it down. We use vision boards or dream boards. Some people like a journal. I mean, did any of them talk about that stuff with you?
Not so much about the dream boards and vision boards, but very much around how they paid attention to trends in the marketplace. So you take a guy like Jeff Lurie, and Jeff owns the Philadelphia Eagles. And when Jeff was he was building some movies and television shows, and he's looking at the returns, and he saw, you know, the NFL, if you look at the audience, creates a hit movie every weekend, creates a bunch of hit movies every weekend if you look at how many people actually watch them. So he then started studying up, okay, how could he get hold of an NFL team? And he paid $185 million for the Eagles. And he did that. He had to buy them sight unseen. So he walked into the practice facility. There's rain coming through the roof, rats walking across the floor. And the Wall Street Journal had a big one-page story about what a knucklehead he was for being such a, you know, paying up so much for the Eagles. And he said, I'm standing there in the rain, and he said, I thought maybe they're right. But he believed, he went, in terms of his vision, he went back to his vision as to what was going to happen, which is he believed that the three dominant television stations were going to be competed against by satellite and cable and so forth. And as soon as that happened, the bidding war for content was going to go up. And so he really stuck to his vision, even though he was getting, you know, a fair amount of negative info, both from the outside and from the inside.
What role did any of them talk about other habits they might do? I mean, Mark Cuban talked about reading. Okay, I agree. You have to read everything in the industry. You talked about how this individual is, the other individual is all about visualizing the future, anticipating trends that people might not necessarily see, but you see because it's just so clear to you. Did any other habits, such as exercise or types of people they surround themselves with? I just kind of want to dive further because these are billionaires after all.
Yes. Yeah, they were all fit. So we didn't ask them about exercise, but it was pretty evident that they were fit, and many of them had, you know, private workout areas near their offices and so forth. So I think exercise is a pretty good guess. The other thing in terms of who they surround themselves with, most of them had what we call the performer. So they'll have someone that they work with. They're both thinkers and doers, so they, you know, they're down in the weeds about how the new product or service might work. So, you know, when you look at somebody like Linda Resnick, who did Palm Wonderful, you know, she's down at the level of designing the bottle and distribution and that kind of stuff. But she worked with her husband, who Stewart, who really was the person who did the business execution. So they complement themselves usually with people who can deal with their, you know, whatever weaknesses they have or the kind of work that they don't want to do. So that's a critical thing, is the complementing. And I think the other thing is, and this is probably the most important thing, they need to make it real. So you look at a guy like Eli Broad, when he did, he had the insight that if he were to build a house, and this is up in Michigan, without a basement and with just a carport instead of a garage, he could build that house cheaper and sell it to somebody for less money per month to pay the mortgage than people were paying in rent. But instead of overanalyzing that to death, what he did was he bought a piece of land with his uncle, and they built and sold 13 homes the first chance they got. The first weekend they were open for sale, they sold all of them, and that was the beginning of KB Homes. So, you know, he really had to make it real, and you see that again and again and again, and they think about clever ways to get it done. Another part of Eli Broad's formula with KB Homes is that he does not buy land and speculate on it, which a lot of home builders do. What he does is he buys the land. He's super capital efficient. He gets as much payment as he can from the folks building the homes. He runs it. He was an accountant by training. He runs it very efficiently, gets the capital back out. So he's much more capital focused in terms of his inventive execution, in terms of getting it done.
Okay. No, that makes a lot of sense. I'm curious, and we're kind of getting to the near end of this interview, and you yourself, two questions on this. What are you doing now that this book is done? Are you going back to your profession, or what is your next steps?
Yeah, I'm going back to my profession, but I'm really looking at it with new eyes, in the sense of...
That was my second question. How are you going to apply what you learned from the book to what you're doing?
Sure. It really comes in two ways. First of all, we're applying it inside PwC, and so the producer, we talk about producers and performers, and there's two critical things that CEOs and boards and investors need to look at, which is first ask yourself, what kind of task is this in front of me? Do I need a producer or a performer to lead this thing? And a producer is when you need something designed anew or some way to create competitive advantage that nobody's ever thought of before, not just scaling an existing model, but building a new model. Then you need a producer. And so we're looking across the kinds of tasks that we have inside PwC, and we're saying, okay, is that a producer task or a performer task, and do we have the right talent and, you know, pair on that? We're also doing this. We're just starting to do this work with clients. So we're having discussions with boards of directors, investors, and CEOs about looking across their organization. Because you look at, let's say you're in the banking business right now. I would say to you that you could put a performer on top of any kind of, home mortgage. Let's say you're, competing for home mortgages. That business is not changing that much right now. And, you know, the peer-to-peer lending and all that other stuff is really not having much of an impact, and I don't think it will for a while. But if you look at payments right now with Apple Pay and, you know, the consortium that's going on with Walmart and Walgreens and so forth, you know, that payments, you know, whether you pay with your phone, a credit card, text message, whatever, all that stuff's up in the air. So if you're a bank CEO, you got to put a producer on top of the payment strategy and the payments part of your business, because that's radically changing right now. So that's, we're doing it ourselves, and we're doing it with clients. And then just personally, I'll tell you, I look at the kind of talent I surround myself with differently. I look at the opportunities that I'm looking at more. I mean, part of writing a book makes you realize the leverage point of intellectual capital. I had done a lot of teaching before. I had really not written many books. But when you think about it more like a producer, of course you want to be writing books. Of course you want to be doing radio. Of course you want to be doing television, because those are the things that scale. So in my own professional life, it's really changed my priorities.
Well, I can tell you that based on reading this book, that if you decide to do a follow-up book, I'm like your first customer. Like, I'm there like yesterday. It's a really well-written book.
Oh, thanks, Ash. You're very kind.
All right. Well, have a great day, and keep up the good work, and can't wait to see the more success that this book is going to have.
Great. Can I just say one last thing? Anybody who's interested in it, we have a website, which is pwc.com/billionaire, and that's got videos, it's got short versions of the book, it's got all the press and so forth and contact info. So anyone interested in the topic can find everything they need right there.
Awesome. Have a great day.
Thank you, Ash. Bye-bye.